Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing a reveal investigation about the September 2014 disappearance of 43 students, all young men, from a rural teachers' college in Guerrero, Mexico. This is a harrowing story and so, so important from Reveal. They expose corruption at the highest levels of government and connect the story to the U.S. drug war. Today, we're joined by Kate Doyle, a human rights investigator who worked on the piece with Reveal. Kate Doyle is a senior analyst of U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive, a nonprofit research institute in Washington, D.C., and it has no ties to the U.S. government. They use freedom of information laws to expose human rights atrocities in Latin America and hold their governments accountable. Kate Doyle directs several major research projects, including the Guatemala Project, which collects declassified U.S. and Guatemalan government documents on the country's shared history from 1954, and the Evidence Project, connecting the right to truth and access to information with human rights and justice struggles in Latin America. Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to you and the entire team for this powerful investigation.
Hi there. Thanks for that invitation and the introduction as well.
Well, it's great to have you. So Reveal dropped part one of this three-part series, and part two will be dropped this weekend. So first off, this is just an incredible story. And over the years, we've just learned so much about what happened, especially late last year. First off, can you remind us what happened on September 26th, 2014?
Sure. A group of about 100 students from a rural teachers training college in Guerrero, Mexico, which is in the southwest of the country, were traveling through the town of Iguala in Guerrero, about an hour and a half from their school, where they had gone to try to seize or commandeer buses, public buses, to take to their school and use days later to get them from their school in Guerrero to Mexico City and participate in an annual huge national event, which was the march to commemorate the massacre of students in 1968 in Tlatelolco in Mexico. This is something that students both at the Ayotzinapa Teachers School in Guerrero and students all over Mexico have done for decades, which is to commandeer buses because the state doesn't give their schools enough money to have their own school bus. So the students were traveling through Iguala on five buses they had seized when they were, out of the blue, attacked by uniformed police officers from Iguala, and it turns out from three other towns in the region, though they didn't know it at the time. The police shot at their buses. Two of the students were immediately injured, one of them terribly injured and remains today in a vegetative state. He was shot in the head. And ultimately, from one site in the town, some 20 or so students were taken off the bus by the police and driven away in the back of their pickup trucks. And from another site in the town, because the buses left the town in two different routes, another 20 to 25 students were taken off the buses and carted away. Those students were never seen again. They were disappeared by the police. And to this day, we really don't know exactly what happened to them.
And to give listeners a little bit of context about this, the reporter you worked with, Ana Yancy Diaz-Cortez, said that someone put it to her this way. In these parts of Guerrero, if you don't want to be a farm worker, you have three choices. Trek to the United States to try your luck there, become a narco, as in become a drug trafficker, or come to this college and study to become a teacher. So can you tell us just a little bit more about, you know, who these kids are, or in some cases were, sadly?
Sure. Guerrero is probably the most statistically impoverished state in Mexico. I mean, that you could swap places maybe with Chiapas or Oaxaca, but Guerrero is notoriously one of the both poorest states and most crime-ridden states. It's been occupied by the Mexican army since the 1960s, and it has traditionally offered very, very bleak futures to its primarily indigenous populations, campesino populations, farming populations. And as Anayansi pointed out in the podcast, that there are very few kind of roots out of poverty and a life of farm working. So the Ayotzinapa School, which is part of a network of rural teacher training schools that were founded right after the revolution in Mexico in the 20s, is a free 4-year education program to train young people to be teachers in their own communities. So the idea of Ayotzinapa is to train these very, usually very poor young 18, 19, 20 year olds to teach elementary, middle, and high schools in their own communities and often in their own languages. So they will go back to their villages. They will go back to neighboring communities and teach in Nahuatl or teach in Mixtec. And that's where these boys attended when they were attacked that night.
We learn that the school is free. It is funded by the state, but it is bare bones. There are no dorms. 12 students live in a tiny concrete room with no windows. A single light bulb hangs from the ceiling. They sleep on the floor. The school has really an incredible history. It's rooted in leftist political and social protest. Can you tell us about the school's mission? It was founded in 1926 after the Mexican Revolution.
Sure. I mean, you've mentioned its amazing history. The school has bred some of the most kind of renowned both teachers and also activists and sometimes even armed guerrillas. I mean, Lucio Cabañas, who's one of the most famous leaders of an armed revolutionary movement in the 1960s and 70s, and his colleague and companion Genaro Vasquez, both were students at this school and both grew up to rebel first as best they could in a legal open way against poverty and injustice and inequality in Guerrero. And ultimately in the 1970s, taking up arms, both of them died in that fight. Well, Genaro was killed in a car accident, a suspicious car accident, and Lucio was actually killed by the military. So the school has its roots not only in the history of the state, but also the history of activism in the state, the history of social movements. Kids coming out of that school are given this training as teachers and also training as in the political context and the history of their own state and their own country.
And as you report, these students are known for protesting and speaking out against corruption and police brutality. And the biggest event of the year is a pilgrimage to Mexico City every October 2nd. And you just talked about these students heading. The plan was to head to Mexico City. And that is the day in 1968 when leftist students protesting military and police violence were gunned down in a public plaza. So every year for these students, they head to Mexico City to protest and to raise money for the school on October 2nd.
That's right. They because of the lack of funds at the school, they organize these trips to raise money. Not this isn't the trip to Mexico City. This is before they go to raise money for that traveling to the city and to be able to stay in the city for the protest, but also to commandeer buses to take them there because they have no buses. And by the way, I should say that part of the students' training and the government's requirements of their qualifications is they have to go into different communities and shadow teachers who are already teaching in the schools. And they will often commandeer buses to do that because the school doesn't have enough funding to get them into their required teacher training stints in these little schools around the state. So it's not something that only happens on October 2nd. They are constantly desperately looking for transportation so they can even fulfill the requirements of the jobs they're supposed to do.
As you report, most of the time the bus companies and the drivers go along with it to just help the students out.
Right. I mean, it's it is something that sounds so strange to American ears, but in Mexico, it's a pretty common practice.
You know what was so devastating? I mean, so many things about this are devastating, but we learn that some of the parents who live in rural areas did not find out about what happened to their kids until a few days later. In the case of one parent we hear from, Christina, I believe it was a relative who read her information about her son from the newspaper.
Yeah, Christy is one of the people that we interviewed for the podcast extensively. We went to visit her, her two grown daughters, Laura and Mai, who you will hear from in the last episode, and her grandchildren in Alpuyacancingo de las Montañas, where she lives in Guerrero, which is a tiny village in the sort of highlands of the state. And Christy told us that she was actually visiting her daughter Mai in Chilapa, a nearby town where Mai was going to school, and they were having lunch together when Christy got a phone call from her brother, who read her the headline over the phone. And that's how she found out. It was, I believe, three days after the boys had disappeared, that she found out that her son Benjamin had been possibly one of the boys. She didn't learn all of that on the phone. She learned that a big group of them were missing. And she immediately took a local bus to the school. And as she tells in the story, when she finds out after getting to the school that Benjamin is among the 43 disappeared boys, she and many of the parents basically end up camping out at the school, and she ends up staying there for months and months, beginning to participate in and ultimately lead. Christy became a real leader in the parents' group, lead a movement to demand the return of their boys and accountability for who did this.
The parents say that when they went to the state capitol to file missing persons claims and demand their boys be found, the authorities swabbed them for DNA and they took blood samples, and that's all they did. I mean, that alone is very odd, but that's how they responded to this.
Unfortunately, Mexico has become kind of lost in a forest of impunity and injustice. It is a country in which it is very, very hard to get a proper attention from the judicial authorities. It's very, very hard to get a real investigation. It's almost impossible to get a case from reporting to an investigation, to a courtroom, to a conviction. I mean, if you look at the figures that groups who analyze justice in Mexico, you will see year after year after year, something like 1-2% of murders, for example, that take place in Mexico are actually brought all the way to the final stage of a trial. So it's horrifying to know that the government did not immediately mobilize and find those students when they still had a chance, since in any case of a missing person, of a major crime like this, the investigators need to act immediately. And that's not what happened. The government dragged its feet and did almost nothing right from the beginning. And then it got worse. They did more than nothing. They began to cover up what they were finding.
As you all point out in the piece, more than 90,000 people are missing in Mexico today, and the perpetrators have not been brought to justice. If you ask the families of the disappeared, they would tell you that the government doesn't care and that they have to seek their own justice. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
I think it's one of the sort of powerful parts of the story is that the families of these boys, unlike the families of the boys and girls and others who were killed at Tlatelolco in 1968, because of times were different, level of fear, intimidation, were afraid of speaking out. The families of the Ayotzinapa students in 2014, years after the Tlatelolco massacre, were not afraid to speak out. Or if they were afraid, they put that fear behind them. And they have become really such amazing leaders on this issue of the missing and disappeared in Mexico. They have become leaders on the demand for accountability. They have become leaders in fighting what is this kind of like just implacable impunity that Mexico seems to live with. And so it's not just that their family members desperate for their beloved ones. They are, of course, they're missing their sons, and they have now for almost 8 years. But they are also they've also become activists. They speak out. They sit with the president. They have meetings. They meet with the press. I mean, they've become amazing leaders in a country that is desperate for leaders like them.
Today, we are talking about a Reveal investigation about the September 2014 disappearance of 43 students, all young men from a rural teachers' college in Guerrero, Mexico. We're joined by Kate Doyle, a human rights investigator who worked on the piece with Reveal. Kate Doyle is senior analyst of U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive, a nonprofit research institute in Washington, D.C., with no ties to the U.S. government. They use freedom of information laws to expose human rights atrocities in Latin America and hold their governments accountable. Kate, the other incredible part of this story is that you worked with Omar Gomez, a 40-something human rights lawyer, who basically became the face of this investigation. And at the time, the authorities were doing everything they could to get Omar off of that case and out of the country. But he kept on, and he invited you all into his day-to-day life. He also kept a diary, and that allowed you to really go deep into this year-and-a-half investigation.
Yeah, Omar is an unusual person. I've known him for about 5 years. He and I met when we were both investigating the case. We met in Washington. He had served as what they call in Mexico the executive secretary, what we might call like a chief assistant, to a group of international investigators who entered Mexico in 2015 to assist ostensibly the U.S., the Mexican government in solving the case. So that was Omar's entry into the case. You hear a little bit about that in episode one. As a UN observer, he began to get to know the case. And in the next episode, you'll hear about his involvement with the group of experts. Omar and I began to sort of work together in Washington, trying to unravel some aspects of this case. And ultimately, when he was invited by these experts to join their investigation in 2015 and 16, they broke open such amazing information and contradicted so powerfully and irrefutably the findings, the falsified findings of the Mexican government as to what had happened to the boys, that the government ended up saying, thank you very much, now please get out of our country. And the five experts and Omar Gomez, who is Mexican, had to leave Mexico. So he essentially went into exile for several years. That's when I met him. And when he went back to Mexico after the election of a new president, Andrés López Obrador, Omar went back and was ultimately tapped by the president to become the special prosecutor in a new investigation of this case. So that's why our ties to him led us to be able to follow him essentially and interview him constantly over the course of 2 years for the Reveal podcast.
Can you talk about the challenges that someone like Omar has to deal with investigating a case like this? Because you've got layers of cover-up and secrecy. You have security forces, the police, the military, the drug cartels, and the government. I mean, there's just so much to look at here. And then you have people being murdered who are trying to find answers to cases like these.
Yeah, it's so sad in a way, because if you think about it, when the boys were taken on September 26, 27, 2014, you know, the government had an opportunity right then and there to get to the bottom of this, interview people, find out who did it, arrest them, put them in jail. They didn't do that. They not only failed in carrying out a proper investigation, as they realized the involvement of different forces that you will hear about in upcoming chapters of this podcast, as they realized that this went beyond local police and kind of local criminal thugs into a much bigger group of perpetrators, they began to cover up the case. They began to lie about what had happened. They began to plant evidence. So Omar Gomez, coming into this in 2019, when he was finally made special prosecutor himself of a new investigation, he not only had to solve what is essentially now a cold case of 5 years, he also had to unravel this cover-up. So he wasn't starting with a case that had simply been laying dormant, which is a challenge enough, and finding students that have been missing now for 5 years, and nobody knows where. He also had to go back and unwind to the ways in which the government had planted these sort of landmines of false information and planted evidence. So yeah, it's been a very, very tough case for him. Mm.
Well, and you all talk about the connections to the drug war, the U.S. drug war. I mean, since all of this happened, I'm sure a lot of people don't know exactly what happened unless you were following this closely, because it's been years here. But there have been released text messages between a crime boss and a deputy police chief. And according to reporting, it seems very clear that those buses were part of a drug running operation that would carry heroin across the U.S. border. The students just got on the wrong bus at the wrong time, which is so horrific. But before we end, Kate, can you also talk about, and we'd love to have you back when the other elements come down, part two and part three, how the U.S. drug war is connected to all of this?
Yeah, you summarized it very well. In the second episode, we open with an interview with the DEA supervising agent that oversaw a drug bust in Chicago, Illinois, that involved 8 members of the same criminal gang that are implicated in kidnapping and disappearing the students in Iguala, Mexico. Mm. So that is going to start to tell the tale of how the shared drug wars of the United States and Mexico have consequences far beyond the dismantling drug cartels and, you know, picking up the capos and obliterating fields of opium, but rather affect ordinary communities, ordinary citizens, as part of this kind of massive and very tragic collateral damage of these drug wars.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, Kate, but before we end, I just want to recognize two more journalists who exposed Mexico's corruption and drug violence were murdered within 1 week. This piece just ran on Tuesday in The Guardian, and I'll just read a few lines. Margarita Martinez Esquivel, a crime reporter and photographer who often collaborated with members of the foreign media, was shot dead outside of his home in the northern city of Tijuana on Monday at lunchtime. And then we've got another. Jose Luis Gamboa was fatally stabbed in the eastern state of Veracruz, another of Mexico's most violent regions. Jose Luis Gamboa was director of the news site Inforigio. They used Twitter to call for the appointment of an anti-drug czar who might slow the decades-long escalation of bloodshed. Last year, he lamented how parts of the government, instead of fighting drug trafficking, had been sucked into, quote, a great criminal association with the cartels. So this is just devastating, Kate, but we just hear about these deaths in Mexico on a regular basis, and it's just so important to say their names and tell the stories.
It's not just forced disappearance that is an epidemic, Rosa. It's also the killing of journalists, unfortunately.
Right. Well, Kate, huge thanks to you and your team for this incredible series. Again, the part one reveal investigation about December 2014 disappearance of 43 students from a rural teachers college in Guerrero, Mexico is out now. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to the second part this weekend. And then the third part will be out when,
January
Kate?
January 29.
Great. Well, we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Kate, Kate Doyle is a human rights investigator who worked on the pieces with Reveal. Kate is a senior analyst of U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive, a nonprofit research institute in Washington, D.C., with no ties to the U.S. government. And again, you can learn more about the disappearance of these students at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will discuss coverage of Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema's decision to kill the Democrats' voting rights legislation. We will also talk about the big money behind voter suppression laws. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.